So as part of changing the energy or the your thoughts or your body or the retreat, we're not giving a standard talk, but rather took some of your questions, and we're going to talk about them in a more informal way. And we could have just taken questions out loud, but that seemed a little bit too abrupt. So we want to, you know, there's this gradual transition, and we hope this is a way of caring for all of us in the ending of a two-week retreat. We do want to give appropriate amount of time to work through this transition from kind of the retreat to leaving. And what I'd like to say about the appropriate amount of time is the appropriate amount of time to practice with the transition. I think it's people will easily enough start having thoughts about leaving and be a little more busy and conclude, well, I guess the retreat's over for me, and then just think better. Just get more into it, or just kind of not make any attempt to be mindful because it's over, and I'm not really going to go get as quiet or still or deep or concentrated or something, and so it doesn't really matter anymore. It doesn't count. So I might as well start thinking about vacation plans for the year 2028. But in fact, I think it's actually quite important to have time to be able to sit with oneself and be present and see clearly the thoughts, the impulses, the feelings, the things that come up as we start kind of leaving a calmer state. In fact, there's a long tradition in Buddhism that some of the most important insights don't come from going down into, I like the metaphor down. It's a metaphor, down into the depths of practice. Some people don't go down, they go up to the heights of practice. And some people go, what's a third alternative? Some people go anywhere. And that's the, that's their greatest and best. It's all these metaphors, but some people think it's all about going down deep, stiller or something, and that's where the important work's going to happen. But there's a long history in Buddhism of considering that the really important work actually happens as you leave your calm state or your subtle state, that as you kind of, you have a very different reference point for looking at your life and understanding it from the vantage point of the calm to starting to lose the calm, starting of being still and then starting to think about not having much on your mind or on your heart and then having more and more things, not having much self, and then some of the self starts coming back, and to watch it how it comes, to watch its development and growth, you see it from a different perspective than if you by the time you get back into the full-blown aspects of life, sometimes, there's no chance to see some of the subtleties. So we're hoping that this gives you time to be different, and so having a little different energy here now is part of that. But we go back into silence, and we'll sit and, and have this transition, and hopefully you'll take it as an important part of the practice of the retreat as a whole. So thank you for those of you who have questions, and I think we'll each read a question and respond to it, and maybe one of us will have some things to add, but do you want to start?
So the question is, how can we navigate our crazy national political situation with our practice?
I think you're rushing them into the. I was trying to do it slowly, gradually, and.
I guess this is more the Zen approach. That's oh. Kind of that's why we balance each other out. So I want to share, I think there's a whole range of ways of relating to the political realm. And I want to share just some different ways, but not to give a sense that there's one way to do this, but a multiplicity of ways of engaging with that world of politics. And I want to start on one end. For some people, especially coming off of a retreat like this, what can be so helpful is a quality of protection, really protecting oneself from and being aware of what you're reading and the impact on that. I think so much of what impacts this mind and this body is what I read in terms of the news. And what I notice about this mind is that a lot of times I get involved in reading things that really aren't really informing me, but are just igniting me. And so I want to be careful about what I'm exposing myself to, especially after right after retreat. So there's a sensitivity to that, to really take it really slowly, because I think often after, especially long retreat, I can forget how sensitive I am. I remember this happened when I was in Nepal. I'd done a 3-month retreat in Lumbini, and I'd went back to Kathmandu. And doing a 3-month retreat in Lumbini, you didn't have like integration days at the end. It was just, you practiced up to the end of the day and then you left. And there wasn't any of this slowly easing in. And I remember I was in a restaurant for breakfast, I think with another practitioner, and they had a TV on, which probably wasn't the best of things, and they had the BBC News on. And here I was, and just hearing just like 5 minutes of the news, I just was, just it was so overwhelming. So here I was in this restaurant completely weeping, like my plate of eggs were like starting to fill with tears, and then my poor Nepali waiter didn't know what to do so much with this Westerner falling apart in their restaurant. And it was this recognition of how sensitive I was. So I want to acknowledge that when you go back to, there's a place to really guard the senses, to guard what you're being exposed to. And also I get a sense of taking time to digest, so maybe I read a little bit if I need to, and then to take some time of how that impacts the system. So there's that piece of guarding and even restraining oneself. And then I want to talk about the other side of, you know, I know there are a number of practitioners that have really wanted to, been more inspired to engage, or those who have been engaged politically wanted to take it a step further. They really feel a calling. And I want to honor that. There's something about this practice where we're pulled to pay our dues in that kind of manner. And I think there's a place for that. And I think this is the place where equanimity is so needed in cultivating equanimity. And the only way to cultivate equanimity is getting in there and seeing what works and seeing what doesn't. But I want to share with you one story that I think is indicative of a way of engaging, yet having a quality of equanimity at the same time. And it's a story about Ajahn Brahmahamsa. Some of you might know of him. He's a Thai forest monastic in Australia, and he has been outspoken quite strongly about gender equality for years. He was the one who actually fully ordained a number of women, and as a result was kicked out of the Thai forest tradition. And he still talks about it often. And he was invited a number of years ago to a UN, it was a Buddhist conference, but it was sponsored by the UN. It was for a Buddhist celebration, and it was in Vietnam, and he was actually invited to come give a paper. And it was a lot of, you could say, Theravada bigwigs were there. And so he submitted his paper, and what was he going to talk about? Gender equality. This is what he loves talking about. So he goes to Vietnam, and he gets there, and all of the Buddhist hierarchy said to him, sorry, you can't give your paper here. We don't want this kind of paper of you talking about the full ordination of women or how women are treated in Theravada Buddhism. It's not allowed here. So what did he do? He flew back to Australia because he wasn't allowed to give his talk. And one of his students came up to him and said, weren't you upset that they did that to you? And he said, no, of course I'm not upset. I mean, this is how change happens. Like, this is part of change, is when you invite change, there's going to be pushback. That's the world. Why would I get upset about that? That's just the unfolding of it. And he says, and I understand that. I know that. So I'm at peace with that. Which I think is striking. Like, there's a continual stepping forward for him to voice things that he thinks are important to voice in this world. But also he's clear about the nature of offering change to the world. It's difficult and slow and filled with tension. And people don't like it. Just the way it is. And then I think it was maybe a year after that or 6 months, I saw him at Spirit Rock. He was traveling through. He was actually doing a wonderful thing. He was traveling through the States, giving talks, and all the Dana that was coming in, he was giving to a group of bhikkhunis that were here in the States, really offering support. And I asked him about the situation in Vietnam, and he said to me, it was actually the best thing that happened, because since my paper was banned, everybody wanted to read it. He said, if it wasn't banned, nobody would have wanted to read it. I mean, who wants to read like something that you can read? It's like, once it's banned, it's exciting. So in the end, it was great. So I offer these two sides of, there is a place for really protecting oneself. And if one is called to act, I think it's important to honor that. And is it difficult? Yes, it's difficult. Can we bring our practice into it? Yes.
Maybe I'll say three brief things about this topic. One is, you don't have to get your news from the daily news. And I found that the daily news has a whole different emotional relationship or impact. And I learned this when I was at Tassajara many years ago, where we'd only get newspapers that were a day or two or 3 days old. And I could feel what difference it was to know that the news was old. And I would still read it, and I'd learn, and whether I learned it, you know, fresh off the press, or learned it 3-4 days later, the big picture didn't matter. So this idea of old news maybe is better for our system to take in. And and there are other ways of getting, you know, news besides the daily news. And believe it or not, sometimes I'll get the news from Wikipedia, because I want to know kind of the facts and what's going on. And Wikipedia will sometimes talk about news events, but they do it in kind of like an encyclopedia fashion. And it's really dry. And that's all I want. I don't want to get the emotional oomph that the journalists in daily news kind of adds to it or something. So that's a way of staying current without getting somehow caught up in the emotionality that sometimes can be difficult. I think that one of the things that's debilitating is if taking in a lot of news, taking in the experience that we have in our society, being part of it, not just in the news, but feeling we're part of it, if we feel helpless and hopeless, it actually makes it more difficult in many ways, psychologically, emotionally, interpersonally. Helplessness and hopelessness is very, very debilitating. And so it makes a huge difference if you do something. So if you feel impacted by something that really troubles you, don't just leave it out there and feel like it's hopeless. Find even the smallest thing that you can do, but do something. I think it really does something good for the heart and for our relationship to it. And the last thing to say is, the bigger the impact something has on us, bigger the emotional impact, I like to think that the more important it is. And the bigger the impact, you want to be changed by it. So you want to think, how do I want to be changed by this event, by this what just happened? And how do I want my life never to be the same? If you have a big impact and you're really upset or angry or heartbroken over something and then, you know, and it's happening on the national front or in the news or anything in life, and then you go back to usual after a month or 2 months or something, and as if that never happened, I think it does a kind of huge disservice, maybe even worse, to ourselves, and certainly a lost opportunity. So you might want to consider, how do you want to be changed by this, whatever happened? And that could be very personal. It doesn't have to be that you go out on a crusade for that particular issue. It could be that something that you changes you more locally or something. But so those are three things that occur to me. So this question I have here is, what is the relationship between awakening and the Eightfold Path? And I like this kind of question a lot, because generally people think of the Eightfold Path as the way leading to awakening. The usual way of understanding the Four Noble Truths is the way leading to the cessation of suffering is the Eightfold Path. But in fact, it's possible that maybe a majority or a good part of the way that the Eightfold Path is talked about in the suttas is the Eightfold Path is not the means to awakening. It's how we live when we are awake. That the Eightfold Path is a culmination of the Buddha's path, not the path to the culmination. That the eight ways of being that the Eightfold Path describes how someone would be who is free. If they're free, they'll have the right view. If they're free, they'll have right intention. If they're free, they'll have right speech. If they're free, they'll have right action, right livelihood. If they're free, they'll know how to negotiate and find their right effort. If they're free, they'll know about right mindfulness. If they're free, they'll know about right concentration. And that when the Buddha gave his first sermon, he showed up to see his five companions from before. And the first thing he said to them, because they doubted that he was enlightened, they kind of thought that he was a slacker because he had started to eat some rice gruel. You know, ascetics, that's going too far. And so he showed up and he said, I have discovered the middle way. Middle way between asceticism and indulgence in the world. It's the Eightfold Path. And what he was saying there, I believe, was not that I discovered the path to awakening. He discovered how to live in the world. That was a healthy, good way of living. That was an alternative to those two extremes. And there is a teaching that by Sariputta, that when we, you know, entering the stream is kind of the metaphor for first experience of awakening. And Sariputta defined entering the stream by the Eightfold Path. So this idea, we enter the Eightfold Path with our first awakening. So this, and then the stream carries us. And in another place it talks about, I think it talks about the Eightfold Path as something we become. We become the Eightfold Path. And I find that particularly inspiring, because a little bit out of my Zen background, the Zen teacher Suzuki Roshi said, when you are you, Zen is Zen. And I love this idea that we're not looking to be different than who we are, but to be ourselves in some really deep way, and, you know, drop below the, you know, some of the social conditioning or neurosis that keeps us spinning on the surface of our lives, and really be here for ourselves in a deep way. And in some ways you do that, you kind of also we disappear in some way. And then we really are ourselves. Maybe there's some way that this Eightfold Path can define us as much as almost anything else that defines us.
So this question is, how do you differentiate process, which I'm going to assume here to be the thinking process, from papancha, this Pali word? Want to say a little bit about papancha and how it's different from the thinking, just a regular thinking process? This Pali word papancha, there is much discussion about how to translate it, and so you find different nuances from different translators. I just want to give you a couple because it gives a feeling sense of it. One way that papancha is translated is it means to spread out in one way in five different directions, just like we have pancha, five, so papancha. Another meaning that's given to this word is that it has a quality of illusion or obsession. I think another translator translated as complication. So it is a kind of thinking, but it has a particular flavor to it, this kind of thinking. And the way I'd like to share with you the quality of it is to describe, to give you a description that the Buddha gives, and I think it's the Honeyball Sutta, about how conditions unfold into papancha in a way that creates our suffering. So he says, for example, if we have, let's take hearing, we have a sound, we have an ear, and we have consciousness. This is something that's called, and when these three come together, that's contact. And then from contact, in this particular unfolding, there's feeling tone, so that's going to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then from that feeling tone, there's going to be a kind of perception. And I'll give an example of this. I want to go through it and then give an example. And then from perception, there's thinking. And the word here is vitaka, so it's a different kind of thinking. And then from vitaka, this kind of thinking, there's papancha. There's a complication that happens. And then from that complication, one is assailed by these complications. Let me give an example of this, of going through this, and maybe you've experienced this on retreat. So you're sitting here at IRC, abdomen rising, falling. There's a sound, hearing. Oh, hearing. So there we have a moment of contact. Oh, it's a little bit unpleasant. Oh, car. There's the perception. Oh, that's the sound of a car. So perception is arising. And then from that, there's a kind of unfolding of that of, wow, that car, it reminds me of Sally's car, my friend Sally. And so there's the thought, right? There's an associative link that happens around an experience, maybe. So there's that thought. But then the mind complicates it. Sally, that's right, I lent my cookbook to Sally, the one that my mother gave me that I really loved. And her kids, they drew in it with their crayons and ripped out some of the pages. I can't believe it. I went over there and her partner, Samantha, told me just to get over it. Can you believe that? I wish I would have said something to Samantha right then. As if she knew what was going on between Sally and I. I can't believe it. There's papancha, right? The complication and the obsession around that. And it has a quality of being assailed by that sense. So it has that flavor to it. So again, what I love about this unfolding is thinking's not the enemy. It gets problematic when the mind complicates it, when we start to live in the world of papancha, because what I can notice is that much of the time, I'm just walking around living papancha. That's all I'm doing. And there's a word that's used to describe the Buddha, the Tathagata, at times, nipapancha, the one who is free from papancha. This too is a description of what freedom and awakening is. I still think, but I'm not lost in that world. I can still utilize it, but I'm not assailed by it. It doesn't complicate my life. You might want to become curious about it. You know, some thoughts kind of wander through the mind, and other times there's a quality of being overwhelmed by it. I think it is a helpful differentiation to bring into our practice.
So maybe this question is papancha, but to me it's a touching question. I'm touched by it, moved by it somehow. Why isn't this path faster? It kind of moves me, it makes me a little sad to hear this question. And it also makes me a little bit inspired because somehow I take it to represent, you know, real, maybe dedication to practice and concern. But why isn't it faster? I think that if it was fast, it wouldn't count. If it was fast, it probably wouldn't really work. I think it's fast, it's somehow it kind of loses the depth of what we're up against, or depth of care or attention or maybe humility that is needed. We're in a culture of people who want to do things efficiently and fast, it could be that there are faster techniques out there, places you can go where they have, you know, if you could just get on with it, because there's all these important things to do, and you know, you want to get over there, get enlightened, and then you have all these recreational opportunities, or or all kinds of things, you know, to do. But I think learning patience, learning a certain humility, learning to take the time to really see and understand deeply all the different parts of ourselves. I've known people who've had some kind of real depth of practice very quickly, and sometimes it didn't help them much because they weren't integrated and they remained quite imbalanced. And it's actually possible to have some real depth of practice or realization and become more arrogant because of it. And so not being in a hurry, but to learn to not bring so much self and self-preoccupation and self-definition and self-aggrandizement and that so easily comes along when we do this path, I remember once telling someone, I'd done some long Vipassana retreats before I went to do the 3-month retreat at IMS, and I was talking to someone before the retreat started and gave the person advice about how you could really give yourself over to the practice and really practice diligently moment by moment or something, some kind of crazy little pep talk. And the person looked at me, I think he kind of felt sorry for me. and said something like, I'll receive the wisdom that comes my way. It was much more like, I'm here just to receive what's here rather than, you know, try to squeeze every possible thing out of it. And that caught my attention. Oh. Okay. So why isn't this path faster? Maybe the question should be, how can I do this path slower? Slower and better, slower and fuller, slower and give myself more completely into it, slower so that all of me is included as part of it. Maybe that's the question. unless Brian has a faster way.
Please say something about this word insight or insights. What are they? How do they arise? Are they also to be shed? Do they have a dark side? Anything else to know about them? Oh, those little insights. It's a tricky word because often this word insight can be understood as psychological insight. And as probably many of you know, we gain many psychological insights on this path, and they're important for the process of healing and awakening. So that is one way of understanding that word, but I want to talk about it more in the context of what we were talking about this week, these seven stages of purification. Because within these seven stages of purification, there's the idea that there are these flavors of insight or insight knowledges that arise. The Pali word is jnana. And they're a little bit different than psychological insight. They can intertwine, but they are different. And I want to give some examples around just impermanence. For example, this is one of the things that we gain insight into, is the nature of impermanence. And I want to point out how basic and simple it is, and how insight can be arising in our practice. And it's so mundane that sometimes our minds don't see it as quote-unquote insight. So if you're sitting in your meditation, and the mind is rather collected, doesn't have to be deeply collected, and it's taking in just a sound arising and passing away, a sensation arising and passing away, noticing that a thought arises and passes away, just noticing that again and again and again, is this insight into impermanence. So what I want to point out about that is, hopefully you hear in that, it doesn't have to be some kind of dramatic aha experience. It's the mind taking in that fact. But it's taking it in a very different way, and I think this is what's so important. It's not like, oh, I come to the understanding that now I intellectually understand impermanence. Because if that was the case, we'd all be done by now, right? that's not a hard thing to intellectually understand. It's more to be able to get the feeling of the insight into impermanence. More, to me, like the knowing of how to ride a bike or how to swim. That's a different kind of understanding. Like if you think about, if you know how to ride a bike or how to swim, so just take riding a bike. What I realize about my knowledge of riding a bike, if you were to ask me, how do I stay on a bike? I couldn't tell you. I have no idea how my body stays on a bike, but it knows it. It has a feeling sense for that activity. And you give me a bike and I can get on it and ride it, because there's that kind of noise. Like it's in the muscles, it's in the bones, it's that deep. That kind of knowing. And I think the same way with impermanence, it's deeply knowing it. So it's like in the bones, in the muscles of our being. That's why it's so important, as we talked about, the different flavors that come with this really taking in impermanence. Sometimes it's exciting, sometimes it's scary, sometimes it's saddening. Sometimes we want to turn away. All of this is the process of digesting this insight. It goes to say that insight is happening in your practice, even if you don't use that word, even if you're not having aha experiences. It's happening. And it's hard to notice, just like riding a bike. Maybe some of you had the moment was like, oh, this is the moment I learned how to ride a bike. Probably didn't happen that way. It's probably over time. You scraped your knees a lot, probably. You fell off. And then eventually, it was just like you were able to be up there. It's how it is. Yeah, maybe that's enough.
So this maybe is a little bit another kind of insight kind of question. I believe you mentioned early in the retreat that Mahasi Sayadaw was adamant that placing the anchor in the rising and falling of the abdomen not be construed as breath meditation. Why was this important to him? So Mahasi Sayadaw taught, what he was teaching was what's called four elements meditation. So in the Satipatthana Sutta, there are different exercises there of how to pay attention to your experience. And one of them is involves experiencing things from the perspective of the what's called the four elements, which is the way that the direct sensations are felt. So you might have a sensation of hardness or softness, and that would be called the earth element. You might have coolness or heat, and that would be the fire element. You might have a sense of movement in the body, and that would be the air element. And then something that's usually considered quite subtle and sometimes hard to feel is a sense of cohesion, the way things stick together. And you can feel that in your saliva. You know, sometimes you can feel it, and but other places too sometimes, and so there's all these permutations of the direct sensations, all the forms of direct sensations we can have, and it's by going in and really seeing the sensations for themselves, as opposed to the concepts about them, as opposed to the thoughts and perceptions about them, like the gross ideas about them, and certainly distinct from the papancha about them. And even more, you know, you don't even get involved in Sally's knees, you know, the sensations in your knee, and then not just your knee, but the sensations that are in, you know, just the coming and going, the rising and passing of the sensations, and so you want to tune in to the quality and the characteristic of those sensations, and that was understood to be a vipassana exercise, because vipassana, one of the core insights of vipassana, seeing arising and passing. And so for whatever reason, Mahasi Sayadaw came up with the idea that, I don't know if it was his idea, that it was a very good place to do that, was to tune into a place where the body's moving. And so when you're sitting still, one of the biggest places of movement, if you have a relaxed breathing, tends to be the belly going up and down or back and forth. There was a time in only a few decades ago when, actually I've known people, it must be still be going on, because I know someone who's gone to practice in a monastery where they do this kind of vipassana practice. And that is, you sit in meditation posture like this, but the practice entails moving your arm. You do something like this. All day long. And it might do it really slow. And what you're tuning into is the four elements, the sensations of the arm. And so you're really getting into those sensations, really feeling them. And you can kind of, you do it slowly and intensely and concentratedly, the whole world of insight can open up in that movement. Or walking meditation, same thing. It's a movement, you know, it's a four elements meditation there. So that's what he was trying to point to. And so when people refer to, think of it as, because it's here where the breathing gets the belly to move, it's easy to call it breath meditation. And in Zen, sometimes they teach you to follow the breath in the belly. But I think that in the Burmese system, the idea was, if you would think you're doing is following the breath, that lends itself to concentration practice rather than to insight practice. And the idea of following the breath, it's rather a vague abstraction, the idea of breath. Some people interpret that it means I'm supposed to be following the air going in and out. And so it's a little confusing what you're actually paying attention to. So since it was four elements meditation, he wanted people to pay attention to the biggest movements of the body as you sit still, and that use that as a doorway in. He taught this rising and passing of the rising and falling of the belly, and called it four elements meditation. And he had a lot of justifying to do. And Mahasi Sayadaw, when he introduced his practice in Burma in the 1940s, it was quite controversial. Over the decades, it became probably the most widespread form of Vipassana in the world, with centers all over Thailand and Sri Lanka and certainly Burma and in the West. But when he started, it was highly controversial what he was doing, and he wrote lots of books and stuff justifying, you know, why this was scripturally right to do. And Ajahn Brahm was disinvited from giving a talk about the ordination of women, I guess. And Mahasi Sayadaw went to Sri Lanka in the 1950s, and people threw stones at him because of he was teaching people rising and falling. So it's, you know, it's gotten pretty, you know, you're wondering why this is, you know, it's pretty boring and, you know, pretty, you know, unexciting and doesn't really mean much, and why are we doing this, since it's old school, this is orthodoxy, and you're ready, you know, for something more exciting. 1950s, this was exciting.
I think just a side note, I also think the culture and how it held change was so different than the way we hold it. So the idea of bringing in my new idea about how to practice during that time was really something that was looked down upon. You know, the way to be a great practitioner was the feeling that I am following this tradition that's been handed down to me, and I'm not adding my ideas about it. So a really different way of relating to the practice, whereas here in America, it'd be very different. So I think sometimes that's was some of the pressure that he was under. So another question, what is the value of practicing in nature? Anything to keep in mind? For me, there's been great value in practicing in the woods, and I do like tying it to early Buddhism, just to remind myself that that's where the Buddha was encouraging practitioners to practice, was out in the forest, you know, to go to the root of a tree, to the foot of a tree, an empty hut, out there in the forest and practice that. And sometimes we forget that part of the instruction that we find in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. But it was an encouragement to step out of the village and into a different environment. And I think there was something significant about that encouragement. A few things about that, and I also want to situate it in terms of the world that we live in today. What I've noticed when leading retreats that are in the outdoors too, it often speaks to two particular forms of suffering that I find so much in practitioners and in myself, and it's the experience of disconnection from the earth and the world that we live in, which I think is a very deep form of suffering, so much so that often I think we're not in contact with it. And also the feeling of not belonging, which can then bleed over into not belonging to this earth that we live upon. One example of this, I was leading a retreat in the outdoors. It was a place in New Mexico called Vallecitos, and someone was on a hike and they saw a bear, and it wasn't a frightening experience. Actually, they had been in the outdoors enough, they knew it was a black bear, and so it wasn't the feeling of fear, it was really a feeling of awe, and really the beauty of seeing this animal in the wild. And she came back and she mentioned it, and what she said was so interesting. She said, "It was so striking to see this bear in the wild, and I had the feeling that bear belonged here more than I did." And that was a striking comment to me on two levels. One was, I could relate to it, of I have this feeling. But secondly, how crazy that is. That somehow I have arisen from the earth, yet I don't belong. I'm the animal that doesn't belong. And of course, there's many reasons why there can be a feeling for this, especially the violence that we've done. But practicing on the land, I've seen so many transformations around those two forms of suffering that I think are so pervasive in modern living. And then secondly, for me, taking in the history of another aspect of my practice, of Zen practice, of really bringing in that side of how when Buddhism came into China, how the Chinese mindset influenced Buddhism in really such beautiful and wonderful ways, I find. And one way in particular was the upholding of nature, of wilderness, you could say, of how at times it can be a mirror for what freedom and awakening is, and that it can somehow teach us if we're in the right relationship with it. And you find this a lot in the Zen poetry that comes from China and other writings. So I think that's another element of the value of practicing in nature.
Now that I've stopped drinking alcohol, I feel like I'm doing well with the precepts. What now? Well, congratulations. Doing well with the precepts. I think then, but there's never any end to practicing with the precepts. And I think the idea is to then, I think of the precepts, the behavior that the precepts are, is kind of like the meeting place of self and the world. It's the kind of the, and so if it's good to have that meeting place be healthy and have good relationships there, and I think the precepts establish good relationships between self and the world and that meeting place. But if that's established, you know, in some good way, then I think one of the tasks is to then look outwards more and look inwards more. And those two support each other. So inward is to take a deeper look and see, yes, the behavior follows the precepts, but does the mind follow the precepts? Is there ways in which your mind kills, interrupts, stops, crushes, deflates, you know, yourself, others, something? Are there ways in which your mind and with your inner life, there's a kind of stealing of from other people or from yourself, or is there ways in which you're caught up in greed, and even though you don't literally steal, and you don't literally kill, there's hate, there's animosity, there's greed, and there's lust operating. And there are layers and layers of these kinds of inner movements of the mind which keep us agitated, keep us suffering, that you can refine, keep refining it, looking more carefully, what's going on within. And then externally, you know, how does our behavior affect the world around us? So, for example, are we colluding in social ways? Our society, the ways our society kills or takes what's not given, or is engaged in sexual misconduct, or is lying, or is intoxicating all kinds of people. And you know, many people who believe that they're following the precepts, and they are, what they buy and the neighborhoods they shop in, or the communities they support, the places they ignore, the things they don't learn about, you know, has an impact. It kind of we can support forces of oppression. We can support forces that undermine oppression by how, you know, the kind of choices we make about where we work, where we shop, where we who we spend time with, and so. Start seeing the kind of the social level of how we are as a group, because the aggregate total of behavior of groups has huge impacts on other groups and on the environment and all kinds of things. And so you might think it's inconsequential, your little thing, but you're part of this kind of adding up to something much bigger that can be quite difficult for a lot of other people to live in and be part of. And especially if you're part of a dominant group in our society, that you know, that there are people who are the opposite of dominant, and don't feel like they don't get the same benefits, and the same doors are not open for them, and so how do we, you know, inadvertently collude or support that kind of separation difficulties that other people have? And that's also an expression of the precepts. And then if you're taking a look in both directions, you're looking outside better and more carefully and wider, and you know, the social precepts as a society. And if you're looking inwardly more, then we also start noticing some of the deeper forces in ourselves of bias and prejudice and us versus them that are operating within us. And then we can see how that plays out into the social world as well. So I think that mastering the precepts is just the beginning, and that's really good. And my hope is that once people have done that, it's kind of like that's the entry level for doing this very important work of ethics and integrity. And so once we do that, take care of the meeting place of the two, then we can stretch ourselves in both directions and expand our ethical life.
And maybe just one more thing about expanding our ethical life. For me, what I realized, especially that movement outwards that Gil was talking about, is that I need something much more than mindfulness. Is so much of those dynamics I needed to study and learn about, because I'm often situated in places where I can't see those things. Where it be, if I see myself situated as a consumer, there's impacts that I actually need to study about to learn that. It might not be something that's immediately in front of me, or situated as white or whatever it is, to actually do our studying, that this practice is much more than simply being on a cushion or simply being mindful. It takes that next step sometimes. What should I tell my friends about this retreat? Oh. That'll leave in the hardest question for the last. Yeah, so when a friend comes up to me, or the way it used to be, is somebody asked how my retreat was, what I say was, it was pretty good. And then I go on. It's important to remember that there might be a lot of people that ask you that really aren't that interested. Like, you know, you might be, your excitement about noticing how the abdomen rising felt like stretching, and then it ended, and then that small gap between, and your excitement about that might not cross over and be understood by your friends. Just to remember that. And the way I see what we're doing here on retreat is that there's for me, there's something sacred that we're doing. And the sacred things in my life, I need to know how to skillfully protect them. Because if I talk about them in certain spaces, it kind of desecrates it. It takes the sacred and muddies it in a way that can be actually damaging for my own practice and damaging for what we're here with. So I invite you to hold it like that, of this sacred thing that you're involved in, and especially what you've experienced. And then from there, you might get a sense of the spaces within which it feels like there's a sacred space or some space that can hold what you want to share in a different way. And there might be friends that you have a connection with through the Dharma, or friends that you can tell they're actually really curious about this and what you're doing. But to follow that and to be careful with what you're sharing is what I recommend. And get a sense of what's appropriate for that relationship in that moment and where you're at, as well as I think, two guidelines that I find helpful.
I'm not going to answer this question, but maybe I'll pose it to you. And maybe you'll spend the rest of your life answering it. The question is, what does love have to do with practice? Let me know what you find out. You want to say any last words, or no last words? Well, thank you all very much. And so as you see, it's a little bit different and energetically than how it's been. So be careful with this energy and don't let it kind of spill out. Think of us now going back into silence and going back to practice until we come back here at 7:30. And if you have, so it's a little bit earlier than the usual sitting in the evening today. So we are back here at 7:30 rather than 7:45. And then if you have a boarding pass that you want to print up, you can go to the managers and leave them a note there on the board. And they can, and they'll tell you when you can come into the office to print up your boarding pass.